Welcome to Deception in the Last Days with your host, Randy Shelton. Randy is a member of the Biblical Discernment and Research Center. He has been studying cults and new religious movements for over 30 years. Join Randy as he discerns the deception going on now in the last days.
Last week we were looking at reasons why Satan believes he must destroy Israel and why it will never happen. This was based mostly on an article by Tom McCall, with also some thoughts from David Levy, who works with the Friends of Israel Ministry, and he was speaking at a prophecy conference. And I took some of the information from both of these individuals as we looked at these attempts to destroy Israel in ancient history, modern history, and of course, in upcoming future events. Now, tonight, I want to look at some of my own comments on Satan's attempts to destroy Israel. Last week, I got my foot in the door on that and shared a little bit about Antiochus Epiphanes, who was kind of a Hitler of his day, spoken of in the book of Daniel, and actually who was the first to bring abomination of desolation to the Holy Temple, God's temple of the Jews at that time, and of course, which is part of the double-pointed prophecy, so to speak, because Jesus also referred to a future abomination of desolation that would take place in the rebuilt temple in the future. And so, having shared about Antiochus Epiphanes and his contribution of evil and attempts to destroy Israel, now I want to look at a few other things that are much more current, much more along our lines of what we would recall in our own lifetime. Some of us, if you're old enough, you'll remember some of these things. And the first thing I want to mention is, you know, Corrie Ten Boom and her family during the Holocaust, God sent them without them recognizing that that was what was happening. Sent their family and other people in Holland and other parts of Europe, no doubt, into the Nazi concentration camps as really missionaries to the Jews who, were going to their fate in the ovens, in the Nazi ovens. I remember Hal Lindsey testifying to meeting a pastor who was alive at the time, and he knew of many Christians who had preached to the Jewish victims of the ovens. This terrible time that was taking place, at least it leaves us with some confidence that God was letting Jewish people doomed to the Holocaust, to this terrible anti-Semitism, to hear about heaven through Christ, through these brave missionaries who had gone into these terrible internment camps. And this terrible time, of course, actually showed the Jews their need for a homeland. And, of course, now we know they've returned to Israel, and this is, you know, as fulfilled prophecy continues. But I just wanted to look at an article that I have from the Holocaust Encyclopedia, if it's called, and this is pertaining to those Jews who, when they had escaped Nazi Germany, were really in limbo, and none of the nations were really willing to actually receive them. And it's such a sad time in history. Many of the nations were unwilling to take in these surviving Jews from the Holocaust. And there was actually a movie actually done called Exodus. Paul Newman was in it. I saw the movie years ago. And so these Jewish people were stuck on this boat. England was really the bad actor in all of this. But like I say, many nations were unwilling to take them in. So here is from that article. I found it quite interesting, having seen the movie and knowing that this is a part of history, and maybe it's a part of history that you're unaware of. But again, this is all in line with my comments on Satan's attempting to destroy Israel. The Exodus 1947 was a worn-out U.S.-owned coastal freight passenger ship launched in 1928. It sailed the Chesapeake Bay between Baltimore, Maryland, and Norfolk, Virginia for over a decade. It was transferred to the British under the Lend-Lease Agreement as part of a group of shallow draft ships. After World War II, it returned to U.S. waters. Yet the ship was to take part in one more event which ensured its place in history, symbolizing the struggle for unrestricted immigration into Palestine. Initially sold as scrap for slightly more than $8,000, the ship was acquired by the Haganah, which was an underground Jewish military organization. The Haganah personnel arranged to dock the ship in Europe in order to transport Jews who sought to illegally immigrate into Palestine. The plight of the ship's passengers would capture the world's attention. In July 1947, the President Warfield, as it was also known, left Sète, France for Palestine. It carried over 4,500 Jewish men, women and children, all displaced persons or survivors of the Holocaust. Even before the ship, by then renamed the Exodus 1947, reached Palestine's territorial waters, British destroyers surrounded it. On July 18, a struggle ensued between British naval forces and passengers on the ship. A Jewish crew member and two passengers were killed. Dozens suffered bullet wounds and other injuries. Attempting to make an example of the Exodus 1947, the British towed the ship to Haifa and transferred the passengers onto three Navy transports which returned to Europe. The ships first landed at Port de Bouc, I don't know how you pronounce that, France, where the passengers were ordered to disembark. When the French authorities refused to forcibly remove the refugees, British authorities, fearing adverse public opinion, sought to wait until the passengers disembarked of their own accord. The passengers, including many orphan children, forced the issue by declaring a hunger strike, which lasted 24 days. Mounting pressure from international media coverage pressed British authorities to find a solution. The ship sat for 3 weeks in the sweltering summer heat, but the passengers refused to voluntarily disembark, and the French authorities were unwilling to force them to leave. The British government then transported the passengers to Hamburg, of course that's in Germany, where they were interned in camps in the British zone of occupation in Germany. Can you imagine? They got out of the living hell that they had in Germany, and then they were once again interned in camps there because of the British. Displaced persons in camps all over Europe protested vociferously and staged hunger strikes when they heard the news. What a disgrace. Large protests erupted on both sides of the Atlantic. The ensuing public embarrassment for Britain played a significant role in the diplomatic swing of sympathy toward the Jews and the eventual recognition of a Jewish state in 1948. Okay, now, the next thing I'd like to look at is Harry Truman, actually from Breitbart, and this is from May 17th, 2017. And this was really Truman fought our own State Department here over Israel's new nation status, as we will see in this article. It's entitled, Harry Truman Defies State Department Recognizes Israel. I've been to the Truman Museum in near Kansas City, and I've seen firsthand the documentation on all of this. On May 14th, 1948, Harry Truman recognized the newly declared State of Israel over the vehement objections of the State Department, which was partial to the Arab states and lacked confidence that the Jewish state could defend itself. Truman declared, "This government has been informed that a Jewish state has been proclaimed in Palestine and recognition has been requested by the provisional government thereof. The United States recognizes the provisional government as the de facto authority of the new State of Israel." Truman's brief telegram was an act of immense political courage. For months, his leading foreign policy advisors, including Secretary of State George Marshall, had been urging him not to recognize Israel, but rather to consider a prolonged trusteeship of Palestine after the British mandate had expired. In brazen tactics reminiscent of the deep state methods being used by the federal bureaucracy against President Donald Trump today, the State Department even tried to tie Truman's hands. As one of his advisors, Clark Clifford, later recalled, "My fears about the State Department had crystallized after a bitter incident in March, when, without informing the president, it had permitted the American delegation to the UN to reverse its support for partition and switch to trusteeship for Palestine, a contradiction of a personal commitment the president had given the previous day to Chaim Weizmann, the Zionist leader who would later become the first president of Israel." Furious and depressed, when he learned what had happened, Truman wrote on his calendar, March 19, 1948, "The State Department pulled the rug from under me today. The first I know about it is what I see in the papers. Isn't that hell? I am now in the position of a liar and a double-crosser. I've never felt so low in my life. There are people on the third and fourth level of the State Department who have always wanted to cut my throat. They've succeeded in doing it. The State Department's arrogance merely strengthened Truman's resolve on the issue. Truman wrote to his sister on March 21, 1948, that the State Department's striped-pants conspirators had balled up the issue, but added that it may work out anyway in spite of them. On May 12th, Truman presided over a decisive meeting in the Oval Office. The State Department presented its case against Israel. Clifford was there and spoke in favor of recognition. Marshall objected to his presence, saying, "If you follow Clifford's advice, and if I were to vote in the election, I would vote against you." Truman did not make his decision until that fateful day itself. The president's staff made clear to the State Department that if it opposed him, Truman was prepared to fight a political war against it. Finally, the bureaucrats backed down. The diplomats at the United Nations were taken by surprise. Clifford notes their reaction in his memoir. As the New York Times reported the next morning, the first reaction was that someone was making a terrible joke, and some diplomats broke into skeptical laughs. But reality soon set in. The United States had recognized Israel, and the Soviet Union did the same a few days later. So God's providential care in using presidents. And we'll see more of similar things now as I move to the next article that I want to look at, a couple of our articles concerning Nixon's Christian mother's influence as a child, which led him to help Golda Meir and Israel with arms when they were under attack in the new state of Israel. This first article, it's from the Right Side News blog, Nixon's Mother, by Gordon Howey. We don't generally think of a president's mother shaping foreign policy. President Richard Nixon was directly influenced by his mother to help Israel in a desperate time of need. As a young child, Nixon's mother told him, "Richard, someday if you are in the position to help Israel, do it." Golda Meir, the Prime Minister of Israel, had appealed to Secretary of State for help, but he had no interest in helping. Hundreds of tanks were lined up ready to attack Israel. Several Arab nations were aligned to eliminate the nation of Israel, and Meir knew that the destruction of her country was at hand. At 3 a.m., she called President Nixon to plead with him for help. It was during that conversation with Meir that Nixon recalled what his mother, a strong Christian, had prophetically told him as a child. Even though his presidency was in a difficult time and Congress had warned him not to venture into any foreign policy issues, Nixon issued a presidential order. Within 24 hours, U.S. tanks, ammunition, and weapon carriers were in the hands of Israel. The short story is that Israel was victorious against incredible odds. You might say that Israel was saved by Hannah Milhouse Nixon, the mother of the president, or you might say that this was the providential hand, once again using various people to work out his will to protect Israel from being destroyed by Satan. Once again, another, swing and a miss. Now from Rabbi Daniel Lapin, and this is Susan Lapin writing this article, A Mother's Message, Hannah Nixon's Foreign Policy Advice. She says, "I've been watching a series online called Against All Odds, Israel Survives. The segment featuring the Yom Kippur War of 1973 included an amazing snippet. In 1973, Israel was unprepared when Egypt and Syria both launched massive attacks. 1,400 Syrian tanks faced 189 Israeli tanks in the north, and similar imbalances loomed on the southern Egyptian front. Looking at it rationally, the country's chance for survival seemed hopeless." Now, does that sound familiar? All throughout Israel's history, like we've looked at in the Old Testament and the New Testament, and in secular history. In desperation, Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir phoned Richard Nixon's private line in the middle of the night. She made an anguished plea for American support in the form of armaments. Acceding to this plea would mean ignoring the recommendation of the cabinet and Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, of course, as you know, who's Jewish. On the episode I was watching, a documentary producer recalls President Nixon saying, "I could almost hear my mother's voice. She would tell me stories and read to me from the Old Testament, the heroes of the Bible. And one afternoon she said, 'Richard, someday you're going to be in a position where you can help save the Jewish people.' And when that day comes, you must do everything in your power. On that day, President Nixon, via his mother's training decades earlier, became God's angel. And then this lady says, remember this story. When the culture urges you to do something important, rather than spending quality time with your children transmitting your values and beliefs, remember this story. Fascinating. Now, I mentioned shortly, some time ago, in one of my podcasts, I mentioned Saddam Hussein, who had employed Gerald Bull, the Canadian genius, who had whose specialty was super cannons. And I shared about that before, but I want to bring it up once again because this is another example in modern history of Satan's attempts to destroy Israel. And I wanted to bring that back up again just to remind us all of how God continually protects Israel until, you know, that because one day Israel is going to recognize their Messiah, or at least a remnant of Israel will. So God is still preserving and protecting Israel. Amazing story throughout history. But anyway, this is another attempt by Satan to destroy Israel, and it was at the hands of Saddam Hussein, who had hired Gerald Bull, the man I mentioned, and he had what was known as the Doomsday Gun, which had the capabilities of actually shooting shells all the way from Iran to into Israel with whatever payload they wanted to put on it. Nuclear tip shells, you know, the type of viruses and well, you know, the kind of war that comes about, not just nuclear, in other words, but biochemical and also with disease and such things. Anyway, they could have done pretty much whatever they wanted with this gun. And Saddam Hussein was on top of the world, you know. And then later he got hung. But anyway, I hope somehow he got saved before he went out. But once again, foiled again, swing and a miss, and God protects Israel providentially. Now, I this brings me, of course, again to my own view and my own comments about our own president, Donald Trump, and his defense of Israel. You know, maybe this president, Donald Trump's defense for whatever faults that he may have, and we all have faults, of course, his also desire to defend Israel and be partnered with Israel, who knows? Maybe that was part of the great economy under Trump, the fantastic record-breaking economy that came about. I mean, I don't want to take any credit away from Trump, but maybe it also God was blessing us in accordance with Genesis 12, 1 through 3, that great promise, I will bless those who bless Israel, and I will curse those who curse Israel, could be. Now, of course, you could say, well, now Trump is more than likely no longer going to be the president, and I believe because of a rigged election. But nothing takes God by surprise, and God's always in control. And I think we need to be reminded that by the very fact that we see God's defense of Israel and all the pieces of prophecy coming together in such a fantastic way. I've been spending a lot of the time speaking about Ezekiel 38 and 39. We could be talking about the one world religion, the one world government, the one world economy, and I will be talking more about the one world economy, I mean the one world government and religion in future podcasts. But I thought it was important because of all the things that are taking place with the enemies of Israel, who are the players, the main players, who are going to be involved in that futile attempt to destroy Israel and in Ezekiel 38 and 39, and that's why I bring that up now. As sort of a, you know, in accordance to last week's podcast of Satan's attempts to destroy Israel, now we see it in modern history in these various views that I'm showing you, these attempts. Now, I might just add that Truman, Nixon, and Trump were three presidents who were very unpopular with certain segments of the population. On the other hand, I would say that they were also, part of that reason was they were reviled by the wicked media of their day, the left-wing media, the media that serves mammon, serves their own interests, and is committed to the destruction of what I believe were basically good presidents, again, for whatever faults they have. We hear a lot about the failings of conservative presidents, but you won't hear that from the Democratic media, of which is controlled by much of them. So these three presidents who were reviled by this wicked media of their day and who were double-crossed by the traitors within their own administrations in the State Department, and et cetera, these evildoers who attacked what these men tried to do, they couldn't stop what these men's right decisions and choices concerning Israel. And all of them were used providentially by God, and I just wanted to make that point. Now, finally, I want to look at two more articles. I believe we'll have time. Of things pertaining to God's protecting of Israel against Satan. This is an article from the Associated Press. The author of the article's name is John Gambrell, actually January the 3rd, not too long ago. And it says that Iran is to boost its uranium enrichment. Iran said Saturday it plans to enrich uranium up to 20% at its underground Fordo nuclear facility as soon as possible, pushing its program a technical step away from weapons-grade levels as it increases pressure on the West over the tattered atomic deal. The move comes amid heightened tensions between Iran and the U.S. in the waning days of the administration of Donald Trump, who unilaterally withdrew America from Tehran's nuclear deal in 2018. That set in motion an escalating series of incidents capped by U.S. drone attack that killed a top Iranian general in Baghdad a year ago, an anniversary coming Sunday that has American officials now worried about possible retaliation by Iran. Iran's decision to begin enriching to 20% a decade ago nearly brought an Israeli strike targeting its nuclear facilities, tensions that only abated with the 2015 atomic deal. A resumption of 20% enrichment could see that brinkmanship return. Ali Akbar Salih, the U.S.-educated head of the Civilian Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, offered a military analogy to describe his agency's readiness to take the next step. "We are like soldiers, and our fingers are on the triggers," Salih told Iranian state television. "The commander should command, and we shoot. We are ready for this, and we'll produce 20% enriched uranium as soon as possible." Now, remember, Iran's version of Islam is the Shiite branch, and they believe that their Messiah, the Mahdi, is going to return, but he is going to be attracted by violence. That's a nice Messiah, isn't it? In other words, the more violence and the more chaos they can create, that will draw him like a magnet to come back, you know, on behalf of this rogue nation. So you have this lunatic fringe rogue nation, and, you know, it just makes sense to me that our democratic leaders would want to be in bed with them. Just makes sense, because anarchy and lawlessness is part of the agenda. But here you see this guy. We're ready to put our finger on the trigger. Let's go. You know, and in the background, I can just imagine all the Islamic fanatics saying, "Yeah, yeah, come on. Come on, Messiah Mahdi. Come on down," you know. Well, you know, there is a Messiah that's going to be coming on down. His name is Jesus. Our Lord will return, and of course we don't know exactly when, but keep your eyes on the skies and your eyes on the prophetic scriptures as these things play out. Now, on to the article. Iran's decision comes after its parliament passed a bill. It says it also serves as pressure ahead of the inauguration of President-elect Biden, who has said he is willing to re-enter the nuclear deal. Surprise, surprise. Furthermore, the last article I want to look at along this lines, and this is from Israel Unwired by David Mark. The article is January the 11th, 2021, and I believe I've quoted him in other articles at other times. And anyway, this is very interesting. This is Iran expels UN inspectors, pushing the Middle East to the brink of war. Now, how many times do rogue nations pull this, that they expel inspectors? It's almost like expelling people who want to make sure you have a free election and, you know, an open, honest election. Don't let the inspectors inspect, right? That's sounds good for one side. Well, this is what these rogue nations do. It says the Iranian Revolutionary Guards have upped the ante by revealing a new missile factory and expelling UN nuclear inspectors. With chaos increasing in the U.S. political system Iran is busy pushing the Middle East to the brink of war. First, Iran increased uranium enrichment to 20%, then unveiled a new missile site, and now the regime in Tehran has expelled UN nuclear inspectors. The Trump administration may have only days left, but it is taking the threats from Iran seriously. President Trump wanted to draw down troops across the Middle East and Afghanistan, but was convinced to turn the USS Nimitz around and send it to the Persian Gulf. For Iran's part, the regime wants to enter negotiations with the incoming Biden administration, holding the advantage. President Trump's team understands that Biden and his incoming Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, are willing to give the Ayatollahs whatever they want. With Iran raising the tensions in the region and testing the president and his team on his way out, there is an expectation of some sort of action to set Iran back. President Trump may not want to engage in any military action, but knowing that Biden and his team appear to be compromised by Beijing, Iran's main ally, makes the need to send some sort of message to the Ayatollahs and the CCP necessary. With Pelosi and the Democrats making a move against Trump with days left, the stakes are high, especially considering how different the incoming administration is on policy when it comes to the Chinese Communist Party and their Iranian allies. You know, if I didn't think God was in control, if I didn't know what the scripture says, and if I didn't have the history of God's protection of Israel, protecting them from Satan's destruction throughout ancient and modern history, I might be saying, we're all doomed, you know, head for the hills. But I think otherwise. I thank God that our God is in total control. Nothing takes him by surprise. He's got all this, folks. Fear not, for he is with you. Be not dismayed, for he is your God. If you know him, if you know Christ, if you've come to God through Jesus Christ, then fear not. Look and have an eternal perspective. Because whatever may befall any of us in this life, on this planet, we have eternity to be with God. And God, the eternal God, will never be defeated, and he will destroy his enemies. All those who reject him, all those who forsake or reject the Messiah, the true Messiah, Jesus Christ, they will be destroyed.